It's the words of Jesus, and I tell you, make friends for yourselves of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. Jesus concedes that we who believe and are called by him sons of light, ironically, are not as shrewd or clever as we ought to be with money. And he calls on us to make a better investment of it for our own benefit while we can. As a certain good investment has eternal consequences in terms of reward. How shrewd or clever are we with money? Now, you may know or remember that in the parable preceding the one commonly called the parable of the dishonest manager is that of the prodigal son, Luke 15. The prodigal son is described as he who, quote unquote, squandered his property in reckless living. And we could say it was fortunate. The lost son lost his fortune because it helped him to come to his senses and decide to go back to his father. We read his father welcomed him back. No longer was he a sinner against heaven. No longer dead, but alive. And I trust this has been so with us here. We are now accepted by the Father. We are now alive to God. All is forgiven. For many believers, this seems enough. We were lost. Now we are found. We, like the rest who believe, possess eternal life. But it does not occur to us that we have choices now to make. Choices that shall determine how we are received in heaven. How we are received is determined by how faithful we have been on earth. Now, I'm aware it may be hard to imagine believers living together eternally without resentment, envy, or a sense of failure on the part of some, when we are all rewarded in various degrees. But this is what we ought to consider. All of us will be saved, but not necessarily rewarded in the same way. Some even balk at the notion of rewards. But once we are brought to life spiritually by the Father's grace, we have choices to make with respect to the management of money, for one thing. We make the choices. And that is why Jesus speaks of rewards. And the thought of rewards does not eclipse the glory of God. In fact, it is just as Jesus makes the conclusion to the parable of the dishonest manager. We seek a good investment for our own benefit. At the same time, we are found serving God and not money. Verse 13. Yes, let's take a brief look at the parable of the dishonest manager as a story and then the application that Jesus makes from it. A manager, he's wasted his employer's possessions. It appears certain the manager will be sacked, but in the short time before his last day at work, and realizing there's little else he can do by way of work, once he is sacked, he shrewdly slices off some of the debt a number of the rich man's debtors owe in order that he, the manager, may have friends who will take him in after he loses his job. Doubtless the manager is fired, but his former employer praises him for being so clever and feathering his nest for the future. You probably know the story, but I'll tell you again. The manager calls in each of his master's debtors. He asks first, "How much do you owe my master?" "How much do you owe my master?" 875 gallons, he replies. quick, sit down, take your bill and write 237. The manager asks another, what do you owe? And when told, the manager tells him, take your bill, write down 800 bushels of wheat instead of 1,000. Yes, the rich man commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. He acted out of a sound self-interest. This parable was not addressed to the Pharisees and the scribes, as was the story of the prodigal son. No, the parable of the dishonest manager was addressed to Jesus' disciples, who had, to use the language found in the story of the prodigal son, who had come to their senses, who are now alive to the will of God. And therefore Jesus says to followers of him, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation, that is, with their own kind of people, than the sons of light. Now this is ironic. We, as Jesus' disciples, are meant to be sons of light, those with illumined minds. And yet the people of this world give more thought to their material well-being than we do to our spiritual well-being, says Jesus. Still, Jesus does not leave us in the dark as to what we can do as befits sons and daughters of light. He says, and I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. So it's not too late or beyond us to consider what Jesus says, even if as believers we have not ever considered or it has not dawned on us that we can make a sounder investment for ourselves eternally than we have already made. Have we been guiled into thinking we will all have the same honour in heaven? We shall all be in bliss in heaven, but Jesus even proffers a further bliss. And I tell you, and when Jesus says, and I tell you, he is underlining something of most importance. I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. And even though the people of the world outshrewd us, it is only in the realm of material well-being. We, as Jesus' disciples, may outsmart them by using the same kind of currency the people of the world use, but using it as a means of making eternal friends. We can make friends with what has often been called filthy lucre. One renowned scholar claims the rich man himself is wicked, since in the parable he was the owner of his business, but he compromised his future by neglecting the proper employment of his affairs. Or perhaps the scholar thinks the rich man should be seen at fault because Jesus wishes to condemn riches, just as he actually does in his closing words to the disciples. Yet it is the steward alone who is correctly accused of wasting possessions. The point of the parable is that if an unjust or wicked man can make use of unjust means to acquire himself a future by gaining friends, how much more should a disciple of Jesus acquire by the use of the same unjust matter, namely money, a more certain future in terms of a greater heavenly welcome? Note the manager is not commended for his dishonesty, but for his shrewdness, just as we may praise to some degree a bank robber for the clever way he got off with the loot. What does Jesus mean by unrighteous wealth? Wealth we can with great profit use all the same. And much the same word is used of the manager as that of money. The manager was unjust, the money was unjust. And with respect to money, many do what is wrong with it, not doing what's right and not doing what everybody else can point out as being wrong. And that's what's meant by unrighteous wealth. Someone has said money is always there, but the pockets change. Although a lot of us have credit cards, I must confess. But if we do have coinage, notes, that money changes from one pocket to another. And we're often wary of the way our money gets used or where our money comes from, where it's been. A visitor to the United States reportedly once said, after 14 months in your country, I realise the value of your money, whether it's clean or dirty. And we can say, in fact, the whole universal economy runs on dirty money. It used to be said that the mafia upheld the US economy. Someone has even claimed that if sin had not entered the world, money would not have come into existence. Well, I'm not sure about that, but I know that money fails in the sense it does finally give out. Now, we know that Jesus condemned the riches more than once, and it would be easier to treat money as Jesus' disciples as of little consequence, or we may with some kind of contempt treat it. And this is what Jesus feared, if I may express it that way. Jesus highly valued money, though more in the sense of what we as his disciples can gain by using it. Jesus also knows we appreciate friends. He wants us to have friends, eternal friends, though we may ask what Jesus means by friends as he applies the parable to us. One scholar, in defining friends, nebulously says, heaven will be pleased to accept us. And then he speaks of God honouring those who are generous. Another writer gropes for an answer. He speaks of the possibility of angels welcoming us as friends if we make good use of unrighteous wealth. And then he toggles in defining friends between the righteous poor who are in God's presence and Abraham, Isaac and Jacob as well. But then he timidly suggests that friends could be a circumlocution, that is, just another name for God. Well, I believe that all of these suggestions are worth looking at, but the one that comes closest to friends, I believe, is the one that speaks of the righteous poor who are in God's presence. However, the people who become our friends and who will welcome us into the eternal dwellings are more exactly those whom we have personally touched in a significant way through the use of our own money on earth. Carry over what the parable says. According to the parable, the friends can only be those whom we have particularly helped in their dire straits or needs. Also, they will all be actually in eternal dwellings to greet us. And therefore, we do not think in general of the righteous, poor or needy as our eternal friends, but those whom any of us have particularly touched and helped. And in support of defining friends in this way, we note Jesus talks of friends, plural. Well, we cannot help angels. They don't need our earthly wealth. True, God will honour the generous in heart, but we are speaking of friends, plural, who stand in need of us and who are destined to live in eternal dwellings, plural, where they will welcome us because of what we have done for them. Yes, and think of the hereafter as somewhat similar to life here as we know it. Jesus speaks of friends who will have their own eternal dwellings, in which they will practice hospitality. There's nothing ghostly about the eternal, nothing impersonal. There's nothing unspiritual about the material world per se. Houses, if physical, are not unspiritual, any more than friends are unspiritual. Heaven will be a homely place. Much as we know homeliness now, only it'll be far more glorious, and it will be eternal. Jesus says, make friends, plural. I trust we already have friends, good friends, but probably few of them, if any of them, are in need. There are others of whom we can make friends. Need I remind you of how needy the world is? Think of how you can make friends of all those believers, for instance, that are suffering and going through much anguish the world over. Think of how you can make friends of them with what you may first think of as your salary when you get your pay packet. But it's primarily the means, really, of ensuring the best possible welcome in heaven, if you would look at it like that. The choice is yours, the choice is mine. Jesus goes on to say, one who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much. And one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. Never mind looking down at the televangelist fleecing his hearers, or the big shots of mega churches living in luxury houses and driving luxury cars. It could be that if we were faced with that temptation, we may do the same things. What would happen if our wish of, if only I had $1 million, I'd give it to the church, I'd give it to missions. What if that wish came true for us? We had $1 million. Well, if we are selfish and dishonest already with what little we have, if Jesus is accurate in what he says, we are bound to be dishonest in much, and we shall suffer some eternal loss. Jesus begins with the positive, you notice. One who is faithful in very little is faithful in much. And then he follows with the negative. One who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. The challenge is thrown out. But Jesus forewarns with much care. If then you have been not faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you to the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? Well, we don't have time to look at all that Luke says about wealth and property. He says so much. It's truly a gospel centered so much around wealth and property. But if you could look at Luke, and you could see how we... if we use wealth and property here and now in the right way, it has a bearing on the great honour that will be poured upon us if that wealth and property is well used, and it will be there in store for us in a greater measure. Let's think of it. Heaven, I mean, we say it's a homely place, and it'll be a busy place. It'll be thriving with business and of the highest order of trust. If Jesus can trust you now with comparatively little, he'll be able to trust you in the future with so much eternally. Yet most importantly, what we do with wealth property and possessions here and now determines what will be our status in heaven. And remember that all that Jesus says in relation to the parable of the dishonest manager was addressed to the disciples. We may well have squandered property and reckless living once after the style of the prodigal son when we were sinners and dead spiritually, but now we ought to be in truth sons of light and take the words of Jesus to heart as his followers. We would be foolish, wouldn't we, if we bypassed an investment that gave us a dividend, say, of 10,000% interest. So let's invest wisely with so much more care than we take when we seek the advice of a financial advisor of this world. Jesus presents us with a no-risk scheme. John Bunyan, he's better known for Pilgrim's Progress and Grace Abounding, but he wrote a vital work called Saints Judged. And in it, he says this, and I quote him, "Some think that all this talk of rewards is in opposition to the doctrine of free grace. I am grateful to God that I can say I truly believe we are justified in the sight of the divine majesty by a grace we have done nothing to earn through the one offering of the body of Jesus Christ once and for all. I have no doubt that this grace to which we are being brought by grace is unspeakably glorious and complete. But in addition to all this, however, I truly believe that there is a reward for the righteous, a reward for their works of faith and love. These works may have been done actively or passively through doing deeds or enduring pain, but however they were accomplished, their reward will come." End of quote. And in the same work, The Saints Judged, Bunyan talks of, and I quote him again, "lovingly welcomed by Jesus and hugged closely by Christ on that day." Oh, Mr. Bunyan, weren't you a stodgy Puritan? How could you say that? Yet what a beautiful thought. If that is to be, carry over what Jesus says about being welcomed by friends in eternal dwellings and imagine all the other hugs there will be. Rewards there will be. And if we've been faithful, even in a little, there will be an eternal dividend. There will be joy for all. But as the American writer Randy Alcorn suggests, some of us who have been faithful in much will have more joy. For perhaps our capacity for joy will be larger. Bunyan also agrees there will be degrees of joy. Then, as we draw near to the end of the application, Jesus makes, as arising from his parable of the dishonest manager, we see our master touching on the issue of either serving God or serving money. Now, I guess, strictly speaking, there's been no direct word concerning love of money up to this point. And we could say love of money is implied, for up to this point, the emphasis has been on the wise use of money to gain friends. However, there is that lurking danger that in handling wicked wealth, the wickedness of us may stay in our hands. We can get caught up with loving money. And remember, Jesus is talking to his disciples. We can get caught up with loving money so that we're not serving God as we should. I remember years ago that they used to have roadside signs saying, "Fire is a good servant, but a bad master." The same is true of money. Remember, Jesus is still speaking to us disciples, for even we who profess to be disciples may not be serving God as we ought. We can serve God with the incentive of winning friends in eternal dwellings, with the incentive of greater wealth and superior property to come, but we are not serving God if we love money, if we prefer money to God. Says Jesus, "No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to one and despise the other." You cannot serve God and money. Because money can get a grip on us, even as disciples. And it may not always be obvious to us, but to others it may be when they hear us talking constantly about us. Now, our word economy comes from the word to describe the profession of the shrewd man of the parable. Even the word for house stood for economy as well as manager. Now, that's interesting. So, to bring home this whole matter, I'm just prompted to say a few things that I trust will be practical. I believe in the USA, even preschool children are being taught about free enterprise, whatever that is, and other things about economy. So we can expect some whiz kids as world economists soon. We need them. Well, be that as we may, as it may, I believe that if we are parents who are Jesus' disciples, we can train our children at an early age to be responsible and trustworthy with money. I know a couple of my grandchildren, they've amassed about $90, $100 in pocket money. That's a lot of money for a child. But we can train children to be trustworthy with the money, and even in a small way, learn that money should not dictate the way we live. It's a small step, perhaps, training children in that way, but it's a healthy step because it should lead on to thinking about investment in the true riches if they, as children, eventually become disciples of Jesus. And then, when it comes to falling in love, and hopefully to marry a person who desires to follow Christ as well, what will they do? Hopefully they will seek a partner who will be as concerned as he or she is about what Jesus says with respect to money. For there are many marriages that are shipwrecked on conflicts about money, even Christian marriages. And as husbands and wives, couples need to agree quite closely about giving, praying over a thing together where required, for being faithful in unrighteous wealth is a solemn eternal matter, as I hope that you have seen tonight. As I said before, the original word for economy is the word for house. The true foundations of a home rest on how we use our income, on what is expended, on what is invested. We cannot serve God and money. And it's strong language, but says Jesus, you either hate the one or love the other. Why? We immediately read on from the words of Jesus to his disciples, verse 14, look at this. To learn that the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, what did they do? They ridiculed Jesus when they heard what he said. Love of money can't bear the strain of what Jesus has to say about wealth. Not because Jesus despised wealth, no, but because love of money leaves no room for God. No wonder Jesus said to the Pharisees, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your heart. For what is abomination in the sight of God is often what is exalted among men. We, not sons of this world, but sons of light, let us outshrewd those of the world for our own eternal good, making eternal friends, being faithful so as to be trusted with greater riches to come, using what is on loan to us now so that we are given eventually what is our own. The people of this world exalt money. And if we are Jesus' disciples, well, we exalt it, but only with a view to employing it as an incentive, as an investment that sees seeking an eternal reward for our own good as well as for serving God.